You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a member. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide. Collected Works, Volume 202. Lecture 10, given in Dornach on the 17th of December, 1920. Today I want to make some observations that may seem to you like a digression, though one that will be important for our further reflections. Over the course of time, we have assembled all sorts of insights into the human being. We have now reached the point of examining how the human being is integrated into the cosmos on one hand, and society on the other. And to do this, we will need to consider various things that can help us in our understanding. The modern scientific view of the human being basically takes account only of one part of our being. No account whatever is taken of aspects above and beyond the physical body. But we will overlook this today and instead focus on what the scientific community acknowledges, which has also come to be part of the commonly accepted view of human nature. The human being is, in this view, constituted only of what people regard as being either solid or semi-solid. Flux and fluidity, gaseous constituents, are certainly seen as entering and leaving the human being, but are not regarded as forming part of the human organism itself. The inner heat we contain, at a higher temperature than our surroundings, is seen as a state of the human organism, but not as actually integral to it. We will see in a moment, in more detail, what the significance of this is. Not long ago, I described fluctuations in the cerebrospinal fluid and how it rises and falls within the spinal column. Here, we can also discern how a regular upward and downward oscillation occurs in the cerebrospinal fluid during breathing, rising on the in-breath to lap, as it were, at the brain organism, then sinking again on the out-breath, occurring as purely fluid movements within the human organism. This is not regarded as belonging intrinsically to the organism itself. It is thought, basically, that as a physical organism, we consist of the more or less solid, and at most semi-solid, parts and substances in us. I'll draw this schematically, and there's a plate 9. Imagine that the human being consists of these substances present in more or less solid form, bone substances and so on. Thus, picturing the human being is a kind of constructed framework. The other part of us that is really fluid, as I have shown with the example of the cerebrospinal fluid, and gaseous, is not seen as belonging to actual human anatomy and physiology. Yes, we inhale air, and it passes through us by certain routes, and also has certain tasks before being exhaled again, and we have an inner temperature. But it is really only the solid constituents that are thought to be the organizing element. People here overlook the fact that apart from this solid framework, we must also see the whole human being as a kind of column of fluid, that we are also permeated by air, and that we are thoroughly pervaded by temperature, by warmth. In fact, more careful observation will show that beyond the solid or semi-solid constituents we possess as part of the human organism, the parts within us that are in flux are not an inconsequential mass, but are organized, act within organizing processes, albeit fluctuating ones, and that this fluidity is just as important as the solid organism. Alongside the more or less solid human being, then, we must take account of fluids in the human organism, and also the air at work in us. What we bear within us in gaseous form, as air, is a structured organism, no less than the solid organism, the only difference being that it is aeriform and in movement. Then, finally, the warmth we bear within us is not some kind of uniform expanse of warmth distributed through us, but a subtly organized entity, just as the solid, fluid, and gaseous organisms are. What transpires immediately, though, is that as soon as we speak of the fluid organism, which in a sense occupies the same space as the solid organism, we cannot actually do so without speaking at the same time of the etheric body, which permeates and organizes this fluid organism. Thus the physical organism initially appears to be autonomous and complete in itself as solid body, the actual physical body as such. Then we have the second fluid organism, which naturally cannot be surgically investigated so easily as the solid organism, but instead must be regarded as an intrinsically mobile organism, one in fluidity and flux. We cannot consider it without seeing it as permeated by the etheric body. Thirdly, we have the gaseous organism, which we have to picture as being pervaded and organized by the astral body. And fourthly, finally, we have the inwardly very differentiated warmth organism. We cannot consider this without seeing it as organized by the capital I. This is how we are constituted today as human beings on the earth. This can clarify one thing in particular. Let's consider the blood, for instance. Insofar as this is largely fluid, and the blood therefore belongs to the fluid organism, we find the etheric body actively organizing it. But at the same time, we find in this blood what we otherwise only call temperature, a state of warmth. But this warmth organism is by no means identical with that of the flowing blood as such. Careful investigation, which can certainly be undertaken even by physical methods of examination, will reveal that states of warmth, of temperature, recorded in diverse parts of the human organism, are not identical with the fluid organism or the other constituting organisms. Now, the moment we consider the human being in this way, we will find that we cannot confine ourselves to the human organism alone. The only way we might do so would be by considering just the solid organism, which in a sense is encapsulated and closed off by the skin as a self-contained structure. In fact, this is only apparently so, and would require us to see our solid constituents as a separate solid lump. Actually, the solid body is also inwardly differentiated and relates in the most diverse ways to the whole of the rest of our corporeality. We can see this immediately by noting that the different solid substances in us have different weights, different specific weights, and that load bears down in different ways within us. This means that our physical organism too relates to the whole earth. At first glance, though, we can say that this physical organism can be spatially defined and separately distinguished. Things are already different with the second fluid organism, which we see as organized by the ether body. This fluid organism cannot be defined or demarcated so strictly from our surroundings. Any fluid in a particular place joins up with everything else that is fluid in nature. Although fluids as such are present in the surrounding world, only in attenuated form, there is not such a clear or defined boundary between water within the human being and water outside him as there is between the solid organism and the rest of the world. We are therefore obliged to see this boundary between fluids inside us and those in the outer physical world as being fairly vague. This is even more true when we consider the gaseous organism, which the astral body permeates and organizes. The air we have within us at any moment was outside us a moment ago, and will be so again a moment later. We continually absorb and dispel the aeriform part of us. If we consider only the air, the atmosphere surrounding us, we can say that this finds entry into our organism and then withdraws again. But on entering us, it becomes part of our organism. What becomes our air organism is really continually forming from the whole surrounding atmosphere and then returning to it again. In every process of inhalation, something is built up in us, or at least a structure is modified, and in every exhalation process, likewise, something is broken down again, partially at least. In a sense, our aeriform organism is changed at every breath, not exactly recreated anew, but altered, both on the in-breath and the out-breath. With the latter, we do not, of course, die. The air organism is merely altered, but a continual interplay takes place between the aeriform organism within us and the air outside us. Popular, trivial ideas about the nature of the human organism fail to take account of the different nature of the aeriform organism as compared to the solid organism. Such a difference is even more marked in the temperature organism. Materialistic and mechanistic views fail to discern a fluid organism, an air organism, and temperature organism, instead regarding our organism as solid only. We cannot gain any true insight into the human being without granting the reality of these four organisms of temperature, air, water, and earth. The capital I dwells primarily in the temperature organism. The I itself is, if you like, the spirit organism, which exerts a governing and configuring influence on the warmth within us, doing so not only at the body's outer boundaries, but pervading and configuring our inner temperature. We cannot understand the psyche, our soul element, if we do not take account of this direct influence of the I upon human temperature. The I is what initially activates the will in us, endows us with will impulses. How does it do so? We have discussed from another angle how will impulses are connected with the telluric element as opposed to thought impulses, thinking and picturing impulses, which are connected with the extra telluric. But what are the means which the I employs in giving coherence to will impulses, to impel these impulses into the whole human organism? This happens by means of the will working first within the human organism of warmth, of temperature, see table page 130. When the I initiates an impulse of will, this will impulse first acts upon the human warmth organism. In today's telluric conditions, it is not possible for what I will now describe to be present as tangible reality. And yet, we can find its existence within us as something real if we imagine that the solid organism is not present within the space encompassed by our skin, if we imagine it away. In the same way we imagine away the fluid organism and the gaseous organism, what remains is a space filled with temperature, which does, however, communicate with the external temperature. But the organizing activity in this internal warmth, which sets it in inward motion so that it becomes a structured organism, is the I. And when we consider the human astral body, this initially bears within it all our powers of feeling. These powers of feeling live in the astral body in a way which the astral body brings to physical expression, within the air organism inherent in us. And so we can say that in our current condition as earthly human beings, our I, mediated by the temperature organism, brings to expression the will nature we manifest in the world. The feelings the astral body experiences and gives expression to within our earthly organism come to visibility through our air organism. And our etheric organism, the etheric body, contains our actual thinking, although initially more pictorially than we are aware. For here the physical body intervenes in our awareness and dilutes thought images into more physical pictures, insofar as thinking is a picturing activity, and this acts upon the fluid organism. You can see, therefore, that we come closer to the psyche itself if we consider these distinctive organisms within us. The materialistic outlook, which stops short at our solid frame, and regards it as self-evident that water cannot be configured, but is merely intrinsic to and governed by the solid organism, will inevitably stand in complete incomprehension before the psyche. The soul, you see, is directly present in these other organisms, and the solid organism as such is basically only a kind of prop for the others. The solid organism stands there like scaffolding made of bones, muscles, and so forth, and the inwardly differentiated fluid organism meshes with this framework and is certainly inwardly configured. Within this fluid organism, the ether body vibrates, and there thoughts are engendered. How does this happen? By virtue of the fact that a metamorphosis of what we otherwise know in the outer world as tone is active within this fluid organism. Tone is something which very easily misleads us. On earth we initially perceive tones mediated by the air, and yet here the air indeed only mediates what is interwoven with the air. To regard the nature of tone as identical with mere vibrations is like saying that we are only physical organisms and possess no soul. It is precisely like seeing our physical body alone, without any psyche, if we see mere vibrations in the air as the essential nature of tone. They are only its outer expression. The tone living in these manifestations is largely an etheric element, Plate 9. An airborne tone originates from the tone ether pervading the air, and is the same as chemical ether. In permeating the air, this ether imparts its nature to it, giving rise, for our ears, to what we call tone. The same tone ether, which is the same as the chemical ether, we'll speak of all this again on another occasion, lives largely in our fluid organism. We can make the following distinctions. Our own ether body lives in our fluid organism, but at the same time it is permeated, from all sides, by the tone ether that underlies tone. Please make a clear distinction here. Our ether body lives and acts within us in our fluid organism and gives rise to thoughts. But into this fluid organism, what we can call the chemical ether, also continually enters and departs. Our organism contains a complete etheric organism consisting of chemical ether, warmth ether, light ether, and life ether. And at the same time, quite separately, the chemical ether enters and leaves us via the fluid body. The astral body, which expresses itself in feeling, is mediated by the air organism. But now a different kind of ether has a special affinity with this air organism. The affinity between physical air expanses and the light ether pervading them was something accentuated in ancient philosophies. This light ether, which in a sense is especially borne upon the air and really has a greater affinity with air than with tone, penetrates our air organism to a particular degree and underlies what penetrates and withdraws from us in our air organism. Thus we have our astral body, which inwardly experiences feeling and reveals its activity particularly in the air organism and collides there, especially with the light ether. And then we come to the human eye, which is active via the will within the organism of warmth. This eye, again, is connected with external warmth around us, with the outer warmth that enters and leaves us. We can, therefore, compile the following schema. See Plate 10. But now remember that the etheric body remains in us even when we're asleep, from when we fall asleep to when we wake up again. Thus, during sleep, the fluid organism continually mediates this interplay between chemical ether and the etheric body within us. The astral body with feeling is different in this respect. From when we fall asleep to when we awaken, this astral body with feeling does not act upon the air organism. Instead, the air organism, which, as we saw, is connected with the whole of our surroundings, is externally sustained. And we ourselves, insofar as we contain an astral body with the faculty of feeling, are outside this human body, thus entering the world with which we are connected through the light ether. From falling asleep to awakening, we live directly in what the air organism mediates to our astral body when we are awake. Something similar is true of the eye and the warmth organism. Thus you can see that we only gain insight into our relationship with our environment if we really examine this human nature of ours, which an ordinary mechanistic view entirely disregards. Within us all these levels interpenetrate, and since the eye exists in the warmth organism and penetrates the air organism, fluid organism, and solid organism, it also infuses them with the warmth organism, which is active everywhere. Thus the warmth organism lives in the air organism and, organized and energized by the eye, also in the fluid organism. And then, we can discover, for example, how the eye works in the blood circulation by this means. The eye acts in the blood circulation via the warmth organism. Here the eye acts as the entity, which, we can say, sends the will down from warmth through air into fluidity. Everything in the organism is in reciprocal interaction. But to grasp all this properly, it is not enough to form a general abstract idea of interaction. We must picture in specific detail how we are organized and how everything around us participates in our organism. We will likewise only fully understand the nature of sleep if we consider these things more carefully. Just reflect that while we are asleep, really only the physical body and the etheric body are present in the same state as when we are awake. The eye and astral body are outside us. This means that during sleep, when only the physical body and etheric body are present, what they contain can then work within us, also acting upon our aeriform and temperature organism. In waking life, the eye and astral body are connected with our whole organism. In sleep, with the eye and astral body outside us, we still have all four elements within our human organism, the solid framework, the fluid organism, then also the air organism, through which the astral body acts in waking life, and the temperature organism, through which the eye acts. These remain within us and continue to function in an organized way, just as they do when governed and organized by the eye and astral body when we're awake. While asleep, instead of our eye, which is outside us, we have within us the spirit imbuing the wider world, which our eye, although part of it, then drives away in waking life. Our warmth body is pervaded by the universal spirit, and our air organism is pervaded by what we can call universal soul, universal astrality, which we otherwise drive forth from us when we're awake. Here, then, is another angle from which to consider sleeping and waking. In sleep, our warmth organism is pervaded by universal spirit, which our eye, which is a part of us, drives away when we wake up again. During waking life, the eye takes care of what the universal spirituality otherwise accomplishes in our warmth organism. We likewise drive universal astrality away when we wake up, and allow it to act again in our organism when we fall asleep. Thus, in leaving our body, when we sleep, we invite universal spirit into our warmth organism and universal soul, or astrality, into our gaseous organism. If we observe the human being with an open mind, we gain insight not only into our relationship with the physical and our physical environment, but also with universal spirituality and universal ensoulment or astrality. As we awaken, you could say that the eye and astral body are reincorporated into the human organism, and at the same time they drive away universal spirituality and universal soul or astrality. That is to view things from one perspective. Now we can also observe them more from the point of view of cognition, and then see how these two perspectives cohere. We commonly think of knowledge as encompassing our waking perceptions and our conceptual processing and assimilation of these perceptions. By this means alone, however, we only become acquainted with our physical surroundings. Of course, when we undertake spiritual scientific investigation, this does not mean that we grant reality to all kinds of phantoms and phantasms regarding our dream images as having real and immediate substance. Nor will we look into our dreams to find the same kind of knowledge which we seek in waking thinking and perception. Yet in a certain lower sense, dreaming does nevertheless offer us knowledge of a kind, a particular kind of physical self-knowledge. In general, we can already detect here how we dream certain inner states in a particular way, waking up, say, with a dream image of a hot stove whose heat we were exposed to, then finding when awake that we have a fever or such like. Dreams are configured, too, in other definite ways. People dream of snakes when there's something wrong with their intestines, or of caves into which they crawl when they have headaches, and so forth. In a dim twilight manner, our dreams reveal the inner life of our physical organism, and we can certainly call this a kind of lower-level knowledge. This can be intensified in especially sensitive people to give really very precise reflections of the state of their organism. In deep, dreamless sleep, we are not usually aware of perceiving anything. We regard dreamless sleep as being of no cognitive value, but this is not true. It does have worth, has its own cognitive task, albeit an individual, personal one. If we could not sleep, if our life were not continually interrupted by sleep, we would be unable to form a clear sense of our I, or have a proper inner life. We would only experience externalities and would identify entirely with them. People do not take enough account of this, only because they are accustomed to regarding what they experience in both soul and body with an open enough mind. We look back on our life and trace the images of our experiences back as far as we can remember. Yet every night this whole stream of appearances is interrupted by sleep. And when we recall our life, we leave this out. We forget to include the fact that our stream of memories is repeatedly interrupted by sleep. The fact that it is means that in a sense we not only gaze upon a filled-in picture, but also, albeit unconsciously, into a void. Here's a white area with black at its center, on a blackboard, plate 10. The black here is a void compared to the white area. We won't worry for now that this is not entirely accurate. We see the black area, realize that something is omitted, left out, at the center of the white area, but that this is really a positive impression, although not one identical with our impressions of the white field. The black area is just as positive an impression. In the same way, we have a positive experience when we look back in memory, without anything flowing into this recall of the periods when we spent asleep, which we spent asleep. These periods of sleep are likewise contained in our recall, though not directly accessible to our awareness, since the latter orients itself only to the images remaining from our waking life. And yet, this awareness of ours is inwardly strengthened by the fact that our inner field of vision, as it looks back, also contains empty spaces. It is by virtue of this that our very awareness sustains itself insofar as it is an interior one. We would lose ourselves entirely and be given up to the outer world if we never slept, if our waking life were not repeatedly interrupted by sleep. We have inner knowledge of ourselves due to dreamless sleep. But whereas dream-filled sleep chaotically reflects certain parts of ourselves in images, dreamless sleep gives us an awareness of our whole human nature as organism, thus also a kind of knowledge. In waking consciousness we perceive the world. In dreams, albeit in a dim and nebulous way, we perceive various aspects of our inner states, of organic existence. And in dreamless sleep, we have knowledge of our overall organism. This is a dim, dull knowledge, but one which conveys our whole organism to us. And so we can discern three levels of knowledge here, those of sleep, dream-filled sleep, and waking life. Then we come to the three higher states of knowledge, imagination, inspiration, and intuition, which as higher states above waking consciousness grow ever clearer, provide us with ever clearer perceptions and knowledge. They contrast with our descent below the level of ordinary consciousness into chaotic perceptions and knowledge, which, however, are very necessary for our ordinary experience. We have, therefore, a differentiated field of consciousness. And just as we should not believe that our organism is a merely solid one, nor should we think there is only one way to be conscious, that of the ordinary waking mind. Naturally, we acknowledge our solid organism as something clearly defined in space, which materialistic thinking sees as the human organism per se. And likewise, we acknowledge our ordinary consciousness, whose thinking has clear, defined contours. But we cannot make do with this only. It is not true to say that we only have this solid body, nor that we only have our ordinary waking awareness, but rather our solid body is permeated with a body of fluids with its own inner fluctuating organism, and our bright, clear day consciousness is permeated by dream consciousness, whose dreams have no clearly defined shape, but instead fluctuate and blur. Here our consciousness becomes fluid. And then, as well, we have the air organism, which is even sustained by something other than ourselves when we are asleep, and basically, therefore, only has a partial, transient connection with our psyche, being connected with it during waking life. And this, too, is a distinct organism within us. Then we have a third type of consciousness, a dim, occluded one, in dreamless sleep. Not only does our thinking grow blurred and nebulous here, but dulls and darkens to the point where consciousness itself ceases, in a sense, to be experienced inwardly by us as a conscious state, just as we cease to experience our aeriform organism when we sleep. Thus, whether we study human nature inwardly or outwardly, we continually broaden our view of it, passing from the solid body to the fluid body, the air body, and the warmth body. We enter the realm of the psyche. If we pass from clear day consciousness to dream consciousness, we enter the body, and enter it still more thoroughly when we know ourselves to dwell within it in the consciousness of dreamless sleep. If we trace our waking consciousness down as far as sleep consciousness, in terms of differentiated forms of consciousness, we enter corporeality. When we study this corporeality itself, ascending from its solid state to its state of temperature, we emerge from the body. And so, you see, it is necessary not simply to accept the prejudices of an external mode of study, which clings in its materialistic and mechanistic thinking to the solid body on the one hand and the psyche on the other, recognizing only a waking form of consciousness with clearly defined thoughts. This view makes no allowance for a descent from this consciousness into the body, a descent into the body from the spiritual or warmth body. Instead, these two aspects stand in unconnected opposition in mainstream psychology: the solid body without the body of fluid air and warmth, and clear waking consciousness without the dream and sleep consciousness that in fact reflect our inner corporeal nature. How do the soul and spirit live in the physical body? We have the solid body, the fluid body, the air body, and the warmth body. Via the warmth body, the eye develops ordinary, clear waking consciousness. But as we descend, we enter dream consciousness and then deep dreamless sleep consciousness. Down here, plate 10, shaded, as you know from title Occult Science, there is a state of consciousness which we will leave aside at present. If we inquire into the relationship between this right-hand column and the left-hand one, these accord with each other, for here, left arrow, we are rising up from below into the soul realm, and here, descending from above downward into the corporeal realm. The right-hand and left-hand sides accord with each other, belong together. But in external or empirical science, only the solid body is really considered, and then also this state of consciousness, I. So here we have the I hanging in the air and the solid body standing on the ground, and never the twain shall meet. If you read modern treatises on psychology, you will find the most incredible hypotheses about how the psyche works upon the body. Yet this is because they consider only a part of the body alongside a part of the psyche far removed from it. Our contemporaries, who wish to keep to a narrow-minded and superficial outlook, are annoyed to find that spiritual science continually seeks the whole picture, that it has to create a bridge between the body and the soul, and truly explores how the psyche becomes corporeal and the body becomes psychological. Tomorrow we will discuss this further. The end of Lecture 10.